Big Adventures with Brian Durker is brought to you by SWCA. Since our founding in Flagstaff in 1981, SWCA Environmental Consultants has helped public and private clients overcome environmental challenges and move their projects forward. As we celebrate our 40th year in business, our 100% employee-owned firm offers comprehensive environmental planning, regulatory compliance, and natural and cultural resources management services. We are the problem solvers, the scientists, the planners, the technical specialists, and the creative thinkers. Thank you, SWCA, for your support of Big Adventures.
Big Adventures with Brian Durker and Matt Fahey this morning. And Matt, I always like to start out with your early years. Where were you born? Let's talk a little bit about your youth.
I was born in Fresno, California, and only spent 2 years there, thankfully. I was recently there working on a project, and I called my dad and I said, yeah, I don't know if I ever thanked you for getting me out of here when I was two, but I'm thanking you now. And then I moved to Denver and lived there for 2 years. Hardly remember that, but then moved to Tucson when I was four. And I grew up there and lived there until I was around 22. And that's when I ended up in Flagstaff and then got sucked into the Grand Canyon Guide vortex.
How did you get sucked into the vortex?
So my brother was building rafts for Mike Walker, who started Canyon Inflatables. He was the manager of Oars. Oars had the science contract at the time. And I came up to visit after a concert, one of the Lollapaloozas. And I just fell in love with it, with just the trees and the altitude and like Tevas and hacky sacks. And just, it wasn't Tucson, and I was over Tucson. So I broke up with my girlfriend at the time and loaded all my stuff into a U-Haul and pulled it up here in my little Toyota Land Cruiser. And
I just made the big move, bang.
Yeah. And then because Mike was, you know, doing the
intertwined, yeah.
Yeah, he was already in the rafting world. And that's how I kind of got sucked into it. I wouldn't even say sucked into it. It was more like a moth to a light or a flame, whatever.
Like most of us.
Yeah. And so I, you know, working for Mike Walker at the time, you know, this is back in the caveman days of inflatable boats. So, you know, we had respirators we used sometimes, but there was no ventilation.
And this, for the listener, this is actually constructing row rafts, like 18-footers.
Yeah, inflatable boats.
16-footers.
Many whatever. Different kinds we made.
And so, yeah, go ahead, not to interrupt.
And so in that, we were all making minimum wage, which was at the time $3.85 an hour. Every once in a while when we'd start to get burnt out, Mike Walker would put us on a science trip as a swamper to kind of like sweeten the deal. And that's when I first fell in love with it. I just did a run in on a science trip, hiked out. And then a year later, I wasn't working there anymore and I was going to school at NAU. And I needed a job for the summer. And I started working at CanX in the warehouse, and I'd already had experience with boats, and I used to do construction, so I kind of already had the mechanical skills they needed. Then that summer, they put me on my first commercial trip, and then that's when I really got sucked in. I was like, I want to be a guide someday. So at the end of that season, I did my first baggage boat, and then the following year, I started volunteering on science trips, and I did... I remember I swamped for Steve Bledsoe and Stuart Reeder.
There's a couple big names.
Yeah, and I think at the time collectively they had like just under maybe 800 trips or something like that together. Well, this is how I got it in my head that I was going to do a 100 Grand Canyon trips. was I was at Joe's place with JP, and somebody's like, hey, you're going on your 100th trip, aren't you? And he's like, oh, yeah. And I'm like, you have 100 Grand Canyon trips? And at the time, I think I had 6, and I was like, I want to do 100 Grand Canyon trips. And I just kind of kept that in the back of my mind until I pulled it off. And then once I pull it off, I'm like, okay, I put a little too much effort into this. I'm backing off. So I think I'm at like 101 or 2. I forgot a few, but I had a journal where I'd write them down. And then when I think I left some out, but I'm like, okay, now I know it's 100.
I'm done. You spilled a beer on it and the ink ran or something like that. Now, so you went to high school in Tucson.
I did. I went to a Catholic high school in Tucson, South Point Catholic High School.
Oh, and, South Point, yeah.
Yeah, and I actually, that's where I gave up Catholicism for Lent.
Well, we don't need to go into too much detail on that because I'm sure we have a lot of God-fearing listeners, so let's...
Yeah, we can cut that out.
Well, you know, one of the big rules is we don't talk much about politics and we don't talk much about religion, but...
Yeah, hey, we call it split in the room when you, like, say, bring up politics on a TV show, because it's like, oh, and if you have one of your subjects talking about good or bad about a president or somebody in pop culture that people find polarizing, you split the room, you know? And it's like, we tried not to do that ever, because especially with editors, you know, because people would say whatever on a show, but the editors would cut stuff out because you want to keep your listeners at the end of the day. So.
Well, yeah, and that's actually happened in this very studio where we've had to kind of...
So one thing I do appreciate that I heard on one of your podcasts was you had mentioned something about, you didn't say the administration outright, but you'd said how the policy of climate change was not going in the right direction and protecting wilderness. And I thought that I appreciated that message that, you know, sometimes can split a room, although the crowd that listens to this probably is more leaning towards environmental protection anyways. So it's not really splitting the room. It's
in
more
general. And the reality is whether you like that last administration or not, policy is policy, and that's real. And when you re-shrink bear's ears, or if you do some of the opening up these areas for exploration and oil stuff, that you know, the permafrost is at risk, and all those things that that administration did was extremely damaging to our environment. And then the denial of climate warming.
Or deregulating chemical companies that would just rather save money by dumping their waste into a creek or a river.
No, it's down the line. So not to take sides on that, and tiptoeing through that political conversation, policy is policy, and it should be talked about. And I think it's going to take more than one or two or three administrations to fix that administration. But to move on a little bit. Now, when I think of some of the stuff that you've had going on, and I think it's a pretty neat ride that you've had. Of course, I want to talk a little bit about videography and what kind of got you into that line.
So my
where'd that start?
Yeah, my video career actually came from my whitewater career, and I would say the seed was planted when I went kayaking with some friends in Ecuador, and a couple of them, or actually three of them, had brought video cameras, and they were starting to make kayaking videos. And I was like, oh, this is fun. And every once in a while, I'd shoot the camera and get something. And, you know, while that person whose camera it was running a rapid or whatever. So when I got back and I started my Grand Canyon season, I had said, you know, I'm going to buy a video camera this year at some point. So towards the end of the year, I bought my first video camera and I started shooting a little bit in Grand Canyon. And then I went to... I went to Gali season out in West Virginia.
Oh, wow.
And I had my camera and I was just paddling for fun. And some guy saw me and he's like, hey, do you want to be a video boater for me? And I was like, all right, you know. And he's like, yeah, you can use one of mine. I'm like, well, I have mine right here. And he's like, oh, really? He's like, well, I'll pay you extra if you use your own camera. So I was like, all right. And so suddenly my first week on the Gali, just there having fun, suddenly I was getting paid to go kayaking. And it was like a dream come true.
Develop your video craft. Huh?
Yeah. And so
that's a very cool story.
So then after that, I started shooting videos on my commercial trips, and people would be like, hey, what are you going to do with that video? And I don't know. I just enjoy it. And they're like, well, do you want to make videos, you know, of a trip? We'll pay you for some of the stuff you shot. And I was like, all right, you know, and so, and at the time I didn't know it was illegal. I just was like, oh, this is an opportunity to make a little extra money on top of my rate and my tips. So I would take like maybe 7 hours of tape, and I would go in, I would edit it down into like maybe a 1 hour movie. Then I would export it onto another tape. Then I would rewind that tape. Then I would individually record that onto single VHS tapes 10 to 20 times, then mail them out for $50 a piece, which, you know, do the math, that's whatever, like $1,000, which at the time was like, oh my God, that's good. And but that's not even time or the money to buy the videotapes or
yeah,
all the stuff I put into it. But still, it was something I enjoyed. I love the creativity, and I love people. So, you know, just reconnecting with clients after the season and getting.
Yeah, very cool. You know.
So then.
Then they threw you in jail.
They did not. That didn't happen until 2005 after I'd already gotten out of film school. But so to rewind back to the videotape thing was, this is the early 2000s now, and I was starting to become what I call the Bob, the burnt out boatman. And people were suggesting that, you know, Rob Pitagora in particular was like, you know, Fahey, you're kind of bright. You should probably go to college, you know? And I think he was just trying to get me out of the guiding world, which I'm still thankful for anyways. But he, you know, he told me that, you know, when you go to college, doors open up for you. And I was like, well, you know what? I always enjoyed education. And I had education, and I had gone to community college in Tucson before I moved up here. And then I went to NAU a couple semesters here. So I had a couple years under my belt. I figured it wouldn't be that much longer to get a degree. So I was dating this girl who lives up in Humboldt County. Everybody knows her and loves her, Billy Prosser.
Oh, yeah.
And she had just graduated from Humboldt State, and she was like, well, you know, this is a good place to, you know, go to school, and then you can still go boating because, you know, there's not really any good desert boating around here most of the time. So, and then I also fell in love with the surf. So I used to go take my kayak out in the surf and surf kayak. So I had something to do to keep me kind of in the whitewash while I was at school during the day, et cetera.
Yeah, no, it's an awesome place up there.
It really is. It's a beautiful place. I still actually live there part-time. But so, yeah, I went to film school there, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And, you know, in retrospect, I might have done it a little different. But the thing that I got from school was they teach you to jump through hoops. You have to be diplomatic. And the being forced to turn in a project forces you out, and like you're learning as you're doing. And so you may not have done it as well as, say, I would have done it now. I would, you know, learn different aspects of filmmaking and whatnot. And so, although I did learn some things from my teachers and my professors at film school, most of the stuff I learned having to do, forced to do these projects. So that's what I got out of school, out of film school.
Well, yeah, it's there's a certain process that you learn the hard way, generally, is how most of us do it. But that makes absolute sense.
Yeah, and then to tell the truth, you know, I still, when I look back at that, I was still such a neophyte. And for instance, when I got out, and actually this ties back into this podcast we're doing, is I was thinking, you know, the guiding community in Grand Canyon, you know, there's still a lot of people around who were here when rafting was revolutionized, and kind of all the things that we now know as our basics were figured out in the like late 60s, early 70s. And a lot of these tools and crafts that we use now are still used today. And I thought, you know, a lot of these people, I should start documenting some of these guides, because I found the guiding community to be such an interesting.
It's a pretty dynamic bunch, really.
Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, not a lot of idiots and assholes last long in this business, but a lot of poor people do. Good poor people.
Good, well-meaning poor people.
Absolutely. So I started going around and doing these, and I still have all these mini DV tapes stored on my property of over 100 interviews I've done with people, including yourself.
Right.
I did, you know, Brad Demick a few times, Richard Cordaroli. So I'm doing all these interviews and I'm banking them. And then that's when, and I was starting to shoot interviews on the river, and I want to make a documentary about the community, but also the place that inspires us, Grand Canyon. And so I was at the ramp and one of the rangers saw me shooting and he's like, "Hey, do you have a filming permit?" And I said, "No, you need a filming permit?" And he's like, "Yeah, it's only $100. Don't worry about it." So I'm like, okay. So then I write into one of the park guys. I forget his name now. And then suddenly I find out there's an investigation on me because, well, first he's like, okay, it's $100 for the permit. You need to get $1 million insurance policy, which to me, I was like, what, $1 million? Mm-hmm. I was thinking that's how much it costs, not that you pay whatever the fee is, $1,000 or whatever it is, which I didn't have at the time. And then the other was, when I go on the river, they have to send a park representative with me. And I'm like, I'm working on a commercial trip and you want me to pay you to send some guy on the river to monitor me the whole time? And I even asked him, what's the $1 million insurance policy for? And he's like, well, in case you do any damage to the canyon. And I'm like thinking, I'm just standing on rocks. Like, I'm stepping on weeds occasionally, but I do that anyways in my job, not, you know, just adventuring, running around in Grand Canyon. Anyways, so I basically just kind of like, well, I'm just going to like delete the email. And then I get an email from the filming person, not the ranger, but the filming person. And she's like, "Hey, the money you sent in, it's the end of the fiscal year. You're going to have to, do the permit and pay for this and do the application or you're going to lose your $100. And I, like an idiot, this is when I learned that it's better to ask for forgiveness. But I emailed her back, "Well, what if I already shot it?" Then the next thing I know, I get an email from this ranger. I can't remember his name. But send an email and he's like, "We need to talk to you about your unpermitted filming in Grand Canyon." And so I call him. He's like, we're gonna prosecute you for this or that if you bring a camera on any trip. And I was like, okay. But I of course, would still bring my camera. But it's not like they're up on the rim watching me, you know, as I'm running on the car to make sure didn't have a camera. But so then that following spring, I was on a Park Service trip. And we're getting ready to do this long 20-day trails trip. And that ranger walks into the place. He's like, "Are you Matt Fahey?" And I'm like, "Yeah." And he's like, "You're not bringing your camera, are you?" And I was like, "Oh, no, I'm not." And I was. I had it with me. And my friends who all on the trip were like, "Dude, are you bringing your video camera? I want my run at Lava and my run here." I'm like, "Yeah, dude, we're bringing it." But the ranger shut me down. So then that was the first time I actually brought a film camera. My mom had given me our old family camera. And I didn't want to get in any trouble, so I just brought that. And that was the first time I took stills and ended up taking some great pictures and, like, actually sold a couple prints from that trip, which was probably illegal too. But I always knew in my heart, I'm like, look, people are coming down here with, like, you know, this is before smartphones, but there were still phones on cameras. People come down with cameras all the time. It's our national park. We own this, not Mr. Ranger. And it's like, I'm not a film crew from Hollywood coming in with a big pile of money and a crew that's going to squash down all the weeds. I'm just one guy with a little camera and a waterproof box, not doing any damage. So I knew in my heart that that if I actually was going to go,
bad person.
Well, not just that, but that if I had to take it to court, I could be like, make an argument without having to pay a lawyer that like, look, I'm, you know, just the little guy here trying to start a business.
Regular Joe the camera enthusiast.
That's so anyways, then after that run-in with them, I was starting to do interviews with people at their places of work. So I went up and rode the lift with BJ and interviewed him up on the ski lift. And I interviewed
really cool stuff.
I interviewed people where they worked versus on the river.
Right.
Because I wanted to tie that into, you know, all these guides also have a dynamic life doing many diverse careers
and
jobs.
Really interesting stuff.
I went and interviewed Richard Corderoli at the at NAU. I interviewed Steve Crothers in his office for a couple hours. I interviewed you at the ramp, I know, at least one time.
At the ramp, I remember
elsewhere,
that.
And every once in a while, just anywhere I could do it. But then I wanted to get access on the river, and I kind of pitched this idea to Alex Elliott. And I said, look, I want to do these interviews with people, but I can't get access legally to the river to do these interviews. But, you know, you might need some videos for your business, and I just seriously walked into her office one day and plopped down and kind of dropped it on her. And she's like, okay, well, I'll talk to you later, and kind of booted me out of the office. And then she's like, sends me an email like the next day. You know what? I think this is a great idea. Never come into my office like that again. Send me an email first or call. But anyways, so that was where I kind of went from the guiding community, transitioned into a
kind of
professional video
photography
thing. And then, so I went down and did a few trips with them making videos for their website. And then the following year, you know, they enjoyed their videos so much. A couple of the other outfitters saw me, Hatch and Ken X, and they asked me the next year, and Fred Netheven, and I bumped into him and he was like, hey dude, you are not charging enough. And I was like, dude, I already have Hatch and Ken X want me to do videos for him this year, and I'm already like doubled what I charged you. And he's like, it's probably still not enough, but good. So, but anyways, all of a sudden I went from being the burnt out boatman to rowing my own boat and doing what I love and not having to answer the questions that were turning me into Bob the Burnout Bowman. And I was still in the place that I loved, doing the things that I loved and being creative, and was making more money doing it. So. Yeah.
And then, so that's a great, great story on a young entrepreneur starting into a skill position like that. And then tell us how that segued into
television.
Some of the television work that you've
been in on.
Yeah, this will be a good story.
Yeah, so suddenly I've got an office and equipment and like a decent reputation and plenty of decent experience. And I had a friend who I met working at Oars who had quit years before, but was one of the people who inspired me to get into cameras. In fact, the guy that I went to Ecuador with.
Uh-huh.
And he had started doing Deadliest Catch. He was one of the original producers on the show. And I remember he called me. He's like, hey, dude, I'm coming to town. I'm doing a private trip. And I'm like, when are you launching? And he's like, oh, on, you know, this date. And I'm like, dude, I'm launching the same day. So I was on a Can-X string quartet trip. He was on a private trip. We meet in town. And he's like, dude, I just went to the Emmys last week. And I'm like, for what? And he's like, dude, there's the show Deadliest Catch. I'm like, you do that? I'm like, dude, I love that
That's
show.
That's a great show.
It
great
really
show.
Is. I mean,
the is it still running?
Oh, yeah. Season 17 is airing right
no
now.
Yeah, no kidding.
So after, you know, a few years, and I'd always stop in and see him, and he'd show me some footage and tell me stories. I'd be like, dude, you got to get me on the show. And he's like, you know, I got this guy on the show. I got that guy. And, you know, but they're here. They're in, you know, Lotus, Coloma. They're, you know, you're in Arizona. When I get a call, I can't just like, you know, I've got all these other guys around me who have the same skills, and I'm just going to pick the closest one. So after a few years of bugging him, I was going on one of my commercial trips for CanX, and I was like, hey, dude, you should come on a trip with me. And he hadn't been on the river for, I want to say, 7 or 8 years. And he was going through a divorce. He was super stressed. He just had lots of success, but he was
still a mess.
Yeah, he was a mess. And I watched him from freaking out and getting like credit card, you know, creditor phone calls at the ramp to getting down to first night's camp and just watching the stress just melt off of him just hour by hour.
Yeah, cool.
Until he just kind of became the guide that he was before, 10, 8 years before. And it was just a great, fun experience. And we were being creative, whatever. And we rebonded. And then I was like, dude, you got to get me on that show. And he said, if you come help me with this project I'm working on in the Sierras this fall, when the phone call comes, I'll get you on the show. So that was between season 6 and 7. I went and helped him work on a project on the Rubicon Trail up on the Sierra Nevadas.
Uh-huh.
And then I was running up to Humboldt to go to my property to get something. I don't even remember what, but I got a call from a strange number and I answer. And it's this lady, Sheila, who was the showrunner at the time. And she's like, you know, do you want to go out with Todd on a boat and work on the show? And I was like, yeah. She's like, I can pay you $350 a day. And I was like, at the time, that was a lot of money, you know. And I didn't realize that it wasn't at the time because of all the just like difficulty of the job.
Yeah.
But
still, $350 a day for a day rate back then.
But as a guy who was still kind of living in his car part time, that was good money. So yeah, I went up and did my first season.
Where'd you go when you say you went up?
Yeah, I flew up to Alaska and then out to the island of Unalaska where Dutch Harbor is, and got on the crew.
Exciting.
It was, yeah, it was really exciting. And in Todd's credit, he's one of the best television producers I ever met. And here's a couple things that he told me that tie back into the guiding world. Was he said, you know, going out on a boat with all these crabbers, he's like, it's like going on a river trip. You're surviving, but you're getting along with people. And he said, it's really difficult out there, but if you can handle it, he's like, you know, producing and shooting, you can teach somebody to produce and you can teach them how to shoot better, but you can't teach people how to survive one or 2 or 3 months at sea with a bunch of drug addict assholes, which really, you know, most of them really are. And and it really, you know, he was, and I, as I look back, I think about all the interactions I've had with customers and with other guides and even with scientists or Park Service employees. There's this level of diplomacy and kind of psychology that you pick up doing the job that you end up kind of
being you were able to apply that, weren't you?
Absolutely. And so as a producer, you're reading people, and then you're also kind of, you're always trying to keep your cards to your chest, because I used to tell people that one of my superpowers was playing dumb, because usually people assume I'm dumb. And let's face it, I'm not the smartest guy. There are things that all of us are good at.
Humble.
And well, but that was one thing was, you know, I'd be out on deck and I had an earpiece and Todd would be up in the wheelhouse with the captain yelling at me and telling me, you know, what questions to ask or, you know, and then the guys on deck would ask me, you know, hey, what's going on? What's going on up there? Or what are we doing? And I sometimes would know, but I would just play dumb and be like, oh, I don't know this or I don't know that. Or like, you know, I know that the captain is up there talking shit about the deck boss or something. And the deck boss would be like, oh, the captain loves me. And I'd be like, oh yeah, sure. And I'd hold the camera up and yeah, go ahead, tell me how much the captain loves you. And then they would use that footage to intercut between these two counter stories going on. And then that would feed into the whole drama of everything. So not just playing dumb, but getting along with people. And, you know, because I always say that being a guide, you know, people are like, oh, you're a river guide or a Grand Canyon river guide. I'd say, yeah, but we're just really kind of a glorified cook dishwasher, you know?
Yeah, it's a food trip with a where we have to run boats.
Yeah. And so I would go in and just to kind of take a little heat off the guys on deck, I would cook a meal every once in a while. And they were always super grateful because usually someone had to come in and do that, or it was cutting into their sleep, which none of us got a lot of. And so that was a good way to kind of get, you know, good with the guys on deck because, you know, where you start on deck, that's the guys that you want to have on your side.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Now, we'll continue this, but what were your quarters like? Were you just in the quarters with the deck guys or?
So the quarters.
Or were you stuck in some closet or?
Well, so the quarters on the boats are different. So the bunks on the Wizard were super narrow, and there was actually, if you were the low man on the totem pole, which I was the first time I went, there was a narrow bunk that usually the greenhorn got, but there was like a vent that came through the wall, so you couldn't actually kind of like spread out nicely. You had this like vent sticking out. It was terrible. And then you were in a room with a bunch of guys who's like, you know, their clothing had cod bait on it, so you're just in this room that stunk.
Oh yeah, I can't even imagine.
But the Time Bandit was the most comfortable boat I was ever on, so we had big futons. Sometimes you'd get stuck on the upper bunk because usually the camera crew is the low people on the totem pole.
Oh, yeah.
So they give you the worst bunks, but it really depends on which boat and how much seniority you had on the show, because when you first get on there, they just call you camera guy. Hey, camera guy, get over here, camera guy. But after a while, you get like a reputation and they're like, oh, this guy's like good, or oh, this guy's an asshole. And they're like, oh, Matt Faye's an asshole. Like, the captain, blah, 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 hated working with him. It's like, hell yeah, he did. But we make good TV because I got in his face and got what I needed.
Uh-huh. Yeah, cool, wild scene.
Yeah,
there.
But here's something back to the bunk thing that I always tell people. So there's like maybe three questions I get every time someone says, oh, you're on Deadliest Catch. The most common one is, so are you guys on the boats with the crew? Do you sleep on the boats? And I always say, no, they have a helicopter that picks us up and then takes us to the hotel at night. And they're like, really? Hell no, you idiot. Of course we're on the boats. That's like one of my favorite things.
Yeah.
I got that from river guiding because my favorite part of river guiding was lying to your customers.
Yeah, no. Even if you don't know the truth, don't hesitate with your answer.
Absolutely. Do not miss an opportunity to lie and tell a fish tale. Never
ruin a good story with too much truth.
Absolutely.
Ever.
There's nothing more boring than the truth.
So, and how, like, okay, they stock these boats up and you head out. How long would the stints be out there? I mean, it looks like it was a... from when the boot drops in the beginning of the season, it's go, go, go until the boot gets picked up and the season's over.
Yeah. So
it's got to be frenzied all the time.
Yeah. So every boat has a certain amount of quota to catch. So
right.
Sometimes you might have a small quota and you can fill it up, you know, in a couple weeks and you're done or, you know, but the shortest trip I ever did, I think, was 3 days, but then you go right back out to sea and you fish until you catch everything. I've done a few trips that went into like 20-day trips, and man, you really stink after, like, some boats, like, you don't have, you know, you can't take showers all the time because you have only a certain amount of water on the boat that is for drinking and dishwashing and all that. So, but, you know, I mean, one season, I think the shortest season I ever had was, now when you shoot the show, there was king crab and then there was Opelia. So you'd go up, do king crab before Christmas. And the shortest ones, I think, were maybe like 3 weeks. But then one Opelia season, I remember I flew in after Christmas. And I didn't fly out until mid-April.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so I was there for, gosh, I guess it was three and a half months maybe. And man, my bank account looked good after that season. But I really made some great TV I cut my teeth on that show.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I tell people all the time, I try to be somewhat humble about it, but I say, you know, when I showed up my first season, I didn't even know how to set a white balance on a camera manually. And, you know, white balance is one of those kind of your camera operator, you know, it's like very important for color and color correction and whatnot.
Absolutely.
And I just always set it to like, oh, sun, clouds, neon, you know, tungsten light. I just did the manual settings, or auto settings, whatever. But yeah, I learned a lot about, you know, just camera work and storytelling and producing. And a lot of that came with Todd, but sort of like my film school knowledge, I learned from doing it. And once I did a season and a half with Todd, they put me on my own boat and I started making, you know, producing stories that made it to air. And I was just banking incredible stories on my own from the skills I learned. And you know, pretty much everybody I've ever worked with in the industry, I learned something from.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Some more than others. Yeah. And that actually applies to Grand Canyon as well. I learn a lot from everybody I've
Picks
worked with in that career. So, and then once I sort of had a decent reputation as being a reliable producer and camera operator, I started getting offers on other shows. So,
well, I wanted to lead into that, but I, you know, back to as you went, and it must have been really satisfying to do all the groundwork on a project, but then see a really good quality result get aired. That must be exciting.
Yeah.
It's got to be really good.
Yes. You know, from having my own business where I did everything from the shooting and the editing to being a salesman and being my own camera assistant or whatever, I went to working on a show with a gigantic crew of people where, you know, your specialty was going on a boat, shooting video, taking notes, putting it in a can, putting on a plane to, you know, Burbank, and you're done. You know, and so instead of like trying to get good at all these other aspects of a job, being your own small business
person.
You're kind
of boxed into that one.
Well, not just boxed in, but you can blossom and focus more on making the two skills of producing and being a better camera operator. And those two skills really flourished once I got into television.
Cool.
And then, of course, that turned into, you know, Emmys and that kind of the kudos and the
recognition.
The recognition.
That's what it's all about in Hollywood, right?
Yeah, not just there. You know, I'd come back to Flagstaff and suddenly I was like a mini celebrity. And I don't know, I always felt kind of like poser isn't the right word, but
an escapee from being a Bob.
Yeah, no, it was a great way to escape from being a Bob.
No, it's really a great
but
story.
But it was a... go ahead.
What other jobs did you start getting offers for? And beyond the Deadliest Catch, where did that take you?
The first show I got offered after Deadliest Catch was in the same deadly vein of reality TV, but it was a spinoff of Ice Road Truckers called Deadliest Roads.
Uh-huh. I remember hearing that you were on something like that.
Yeah, so we went to Bolivia and Peru on that, and I spent 2.5 months working on it, and then I ended up just staying and spent 3 weeks traveling by myself. Let's see, so I've done Deadliest Roads. I worked on Live PD for a couple seasons. I worked on a show where I was embedded with the military in Afghanistan.
Oh, wow.
I did a Naked and Afraid in Bulgaria. I did Naked and Afraid XL in Ecuador, which was so much fun. I've traveled all over the U.S. doing different shows. And I mean, while I'm thinking about it, my three favorite things about the job that I do now, not necessarily ranked in an order, but travel is one of my favorites. So, like I said, Afghanistan, Peru, Bolivia, Ecuador,
That's a
Bulgaria
list of places.
Alaska. Alaska. And I've been working on a project, a documentary for a friend who I met working on Deadliest Catch. She's doing a documentary about the oldest qualifying bull rider in the PBR, the Professional Bull Riders Association.
Yeah, yeah.
His name's Ven Johns. He's 47 and he's still doing it.
Unbelievable.
Super dynamic guy. But I've flown to Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I was just in Minot, North Dakota. I've been to West Virginia, Paris, Texas. I went to Fresno recently. I went to Sacramento.
Have you seen some good bull riding?
I've seen some epic stuff. Dude, I was at a show in Fresno where a guy died.
Oof.
Yeah. It was, thankfully, I wasn't like there. Like I was in the back in the locker rooms between, you know, with my rider guy, Ven. And it happened while we were in back. So I'm glad I didn't see it because I've seen so many bad things happen on camera, and as a camera operator, I'm always like, I'm obligated to shoot the truth. And people are like, you know, you're a vampire. And in a way we are, but I always feel like, look, I just shoot the truth. The vampires are in Burbank. They take what I shoot and then they turn it into even something.
Well, the vampires are the people that watch and keep them super popular.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the ones that are drinking the final sip of the vampire blood.
Yeah, no, I have shot so many uncomfortable moments, and I've shot a lot that never made it to air. I've been assaulted probably more than a couple. I can think of a couple right now. But I've been assaulted by guys many times.
Because you're shooting them?
Yeah, because they
don't want that camera.
They have uncomfortable moments, and they don't want to look like an a-hole on camera or on TV. And I don't blame them, but that's what they signed up for. And they signed the same paperwork I did. And so that's where sometimes you really have to stand up to people and just say, you know, look, it's uncomfortable, but it's the truth. And you might not actually regret this, you know, when this all comes out.
No, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
The camera.
So, yeah, that's I had to learn how to compartmentalize myself because really I'm just sort of a nice, innocent river guy that likes people. But I realized that I was working in uncomfortable situations with people in unflattering situations, and that even though I didn't want to shoot what was happening, I still had to do it, and I still had to sometimes even push and be mean to people because that was my job, and in a way it was their job. In the end it works out, and I've had people who I've gotten in fights in, and there, you know, there's some story that one time I shot this story, and this guy had a hernia, and his ball sack, swear to God, was the size of a cantaloupe. And we're on the back deck of the boat, and I see one of the guys come out, and he whispers in the captain's ear, and he just turns around and walks out. I just knew that look. Something's going on. I didn't ask. I just went right into the wheelhouse, grabbed my camera, ran downstairs. I hit record as I picked up the camera, went downstairs. And the captain's wearing a mic, so I'm already like tuning into his mic. So as I'm coming down the stairs, I can hear him, and this guy's telling him how he's got this hernia. And I come around the corner, I bring up the camera, and he's, hey, you can't shoot this. And I'm like, bullshit, I can too. And he's like, there's HIPAA laws. This isn't your business. And I'm like, bullshit. All three of us signed something. We signed away all our HIPAA, and he fought me and fought me and fought me. And I'm like, dude, you can punch me. I'm not going away. And so we went back upstairs, and I'm shooting this. And so this boat had two captains. This guy's like, oh, it's really bad. And I'm like, let's see it. And he's like, you know, don't do it. And this guy whips out his ball sack. And it was,
Shocking.
It made TV, so you can, you know, you can see the blur image, but he whips it out. Instantly, this captain went from telling me to not record it to like, oh my God, he gets up out of his chair and he walks down to the stairs. He's like, guys, get up here, calls the whole crew. At the same time, I'm on my radio. I call my deck shooter. Dude, get up here. You got to shoot this. We're cross shooting this. So we get everybody up into the wheelhouse and he's like, guys, you got to see this. And what happened is, you know, the hernia, his guts were going down into the tear, into his scrotum. And so at night when he'd lay down, all his guts would go back into it. But then when he'd be out and he'd go lift a crab pot or something and they'd squish back into his ball sack and it would literally the size of a cantaloupe, this big. And so, you know, my point here is that I had to fight this captain to get the story in the can, you know, and I told my shooter, I'm like, dude, I'm like, you get over here and you shoot, get there and shoot the captain. And I'm going to shoot the faces of these guys, you know? And I'm like, dude, you got to get the reaction shots because the reaction shots
are,
they're the money. That's what sells. Like you can look at a blur image of somebody's gigantic nutsack and then hear the voices of the people, but to see the faces when they're like, oh my God. Oh! And I had like three crew guys in frame and my camera operator was actually just in frame partially. And his reaction too was great. But I mean, that to this day is one of my favorite stories that I produced.
That's your Emmy story right there.
You know, I can't remember if I got an Emmy for that season. I think I did, actually, the one downstairs. Or actually,
It's right there, sitting right there.
Yeah.
Now, so this is a good time to ask you, so you're a freelance and you are looking for work all the time, or the phone keeps ringing and you're busier than you want to be, or how do you fly with a business like yours?
So, yeah, you know what? For a while, the phone was ringing a lot, but definitely during the pandemic, my phone has not been ringing. I think for one, it's the fact that, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of work out there and kind of everything shut down and everybody shut down. But the other thing is, you know, I'm 53 now. And when I was, I think, 49, a guy I was working on a show with in Georgia, he said, you know, all my mentors told me, you know, the phone starts ringing in your mid-50s. And so now I'm like, man, it's like, I think it's starting to happen. And now my parents are like, how come you're not working? And I'm like, you know, I said, the phone just isn't ringing. And they're like, but you have Emmys. And I'm like, there's a lot of people with Emmys out there. And I said, you know, when you're on a crew with, you know, say, whether it's in Grand Canyon or whether it's on a film shoot on a TV show, do you want to work with the, like, 30-year-old fun guys who are also have very, really good skills? Or do you want to work with the like 55-year-old, burnt out, jaded, not pretty to look at people, you know? And they're like, but I don't understand it. You have Emmys. And it's like, just because I have an Emmy doesn't mean that there aren't people out there that, you know, have, you know, good skills and can't do what I do.
Right.
So, you know, So
what you're saying is you'd like that phone to ring.
Yes, please.
So
ring my phone.
Hey, listen, if you guys out there that are listening have a project, you can always contact us here at Big Adventures and we'll put you in contact with Matt. The thing that I really like about this conversation is just the self-growth that you're sharing. You know, I mean, and Your humble beginnings have a spectacular result because you stick with it and you got your nose to the grinding wheel. And it's a great, great story.
I got one more thing.
Yeah, let's hear it.
When I was saying the three things I liked about my job, the traveling was one. The second thing I like about my job is the people I meet and I work with.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's just an incredibly diverse bunch of people that you end up working with, whether it's talent or your fixers in South America or the different people that specialize in audio or video or producing, directing, et cetera. And then the third thing that I love about this job is every time I do a job, doesn't matter how small or big, I learn something. And it might be just one thing or it's 10 or 15 things. And then I try to bring those skills into the next project that I work on.
We call that an education.
Yeah. And that's fantastic. Just, you know, I hope I never stop learning. I mean, I think that, you know, definitely, you know, when I started out as a raft guide, and then I was so cocky because I kind of more or less started in Grand Canyon. So I'd go up to the Middle Fork Salmon, and I'd be talking to the ranger like, I don't need to worry about that. I'm working Grand Canyon. And the next thing you know, I'm wrapping a boat at Haystack, and I had my Grand Canyon size ego bitch slapped.
Deflated.
Yeah. And that was, and I've had that in many ways, but that was probably, that was the first and probably the biggest, most bitch slap I got in my guiding career. And it was good for me because I learned that just because, you know, you started here doesn't mean that you don't have more to learn. And so then when I started working in South America on the Biobío, which I know you did, then when I came back to Grand Canyon that next year, I suddenly was like, oh, I can, you know, still push my skills here. Like, I know the easy runs and the low water runs, but, you know, I can go right to the pour over at Sapphire or Serpentine. Sorry, I can go over the to the right there, you know, next to that pour over. Or one time, you know, I did Randy's Rock, you know. One time I went left at Randy's Rock, and I learned one of the best lines I ever heard from Mike Pratt. He said, you know, said, oh, pretty brave. And I said, yeah, or stupid. And he goes, you know the difference between bravery and stupidity? No, what? The outcome. It's like, God, that is true, huh?
It is so true.
So true.
How did it all shake out?
Well, good. You know, it's all just about, like, making sure when you get in there and you can't use your oars anymore that you're straight lined enough in there to just let go and let the river take over, because you just bounce through.
I know that place well.
Yeah. Actually, I heard Randog's story about you and him.
Well, what was wild
it.
Is we, you know, we're fishing in that area and it's nighttime and we're done. So we were camped right there and I was in a sport boat and stuff. And it was,
I missed it
just a second, a little bit, and hit the rock. And at a fair speed, you know, it was a boo-boo.
Yeah.
But what's ironic, I won't go into the great details of this for the listeners as far as hitting the rock, but I will tell you, it was the very night that the namesake of the rock, Randy, died that night. And so I think it was kind of a weird coincidence or maybe a cosmic
See, he told me
magnetism.
That story
yeah.
on a fish trip. And I had actually forgot that part, but that you told me.
It was that night.
Some of the things he told me that I do remember was both you guys had kind of like injuries. I don't remember who or how much, but he was like, the next day, this is him telling you, he's like, and Brian's like, hey, I can't get out of my boat. Like, you got to help, blah, 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 get my gear into the boat. I can't move because my ribs are, I can't
no,
remember
we
how
both
though,
hurt.
But yeah, both of you guys were.
Well, and I had to, I got some stitches without any anesthetic or any painkiller in there. That was a little brutal. But we won't go into that.
Yeah.
But in closing, you've traveled all over the world, and I know you're a preservationist, an environmentalist and stuff, and in the places that you have gone back to, say the Bering Sea, have you seen global warming firsthand where you can really say, wow, 10 years ago, this place was this different? I mean, it's just an interesting question as far as world travels.
Well, I would say I've seen the effects in multiple places, including the Bering Sea. But for instance, you know, we used to have, you know, ice come down in the wintertime, and it still comes down. It just doesn't come down as far as it used to, and it doesn't come down as long as it used to. And every once in a while, there'll be a little shift here or there in the currents, and the ice will come down, and people will be like, see? Look, it snowed one day, and now you dumb, and, you know. Anyways, but, you know, for a while, I mean, I did a bunch of winter seasons up there where I didn't really see any ice. So I've seen it there. And then I would say that just generally the way that we treat our planet, you know, it's like I was just in Fresno, and I was in Clovis, and I happened to be near the trailer park where my grandparents lived. And there was a, you know, a canal there that we used to go fishing in all the time when we were kids. No matter what time of year, there was water and we'd go fishing. And I walked by there and the thing's dry. There's nothing in there. It just looks like a concrete, you know, delivery system for water when it's there. But it's not there. There's no water. Yeah. There's nothing living in it. And even, you know, where I grew up on the banks of the Tangiverde and Pantano rivers in Tucson, there's hardly ever water. But I remember in 1983 when we had that big winter and the water was running in the wash the whole time. And there was cottonwood forest down both sides. And we'd catch fish and frogs and scorpions and just snakes. And there was all kinds of wildlife down there. And now I go down there and there's like concrete sides down both sides. There's no cottonwoods anymore. There's subdivisions. And it's, you know, the water that is still there, it's, you know, it's mostly groundwater and it just gets tapped by anybody that needs water around there. It's just underground the whole time. So, you know, when there's a bunch of, you know, old native villages around there and you find pot shards and other signs of native activity there, the Hohokam, now that, you know, the Tohono O'odham, they used to live right there on the banks all over.
And they had canals.
And they were, well, and not just that, they had water year round.
Yeah.
That's the reason why they were there.
Yeah.
But so I would say I've seen many effects of climate change and just general abuse.
Human abuse to the point.
Yeah. In fact, in my neighborhood in Tucson, just a couple months ago, there was a mountain lion that came down and was hiding out at the park next to our neighborhood, and some guy was walking his dog. It went after his dog. He shot the mountain lion, and then the mountain lion went and hid in a tree in our neighborhood, and then the fish and game came down, and then they tranquilized it, and then they threw it in the truck, and then they realized, oh, we probably can't save it, so they euthanized it. But, you know, that mountain lion, or at least back in the day, they didn't need to come out of the mountains. Or they did, but I mean, we were pretty far into the city that a mountain lion's got to come out of the mountains to get, you know, resources to live.
Their territory is more important than making a dangerous move into town. Exactly.
And right. I just wish we were better at kind of keeping our, you know, our transportation system smaller and our cities smaller and just preserving the wilderness, because I think all people, and not all people, but most of us could use a little wilderness time. And, you know, it used to be when I got off a Grand Canyon trip, I'd just go out in the woods and pass out, and I never saw anybody. And now I have to drive further and further and further out to get away from people. And you still see there's people out there living in RVs. They don't have homes. That's their home now. And, you know, what are they up to? You know, some of them are, you know, just innocent, but, you know, whatever, they're, you know, they might be cooking meth like I'm Breaking Bad or whatever, but but it's just, you know, we're not, I don't know, we're just not taking care of humanity.
Yeah, our footprint is swallowing up the wilderness, and once that footprint's there, it doesn't go away.
It doesn't.
And with that, I think the listeners should keep in mind, if you can battle some of these projects that are just for financial gain that's encroaching on the wilderness, and if you can get on some committee that battles it, do that. Let's save our what's left, you know? I mean, that would be a great parting note. But, Matt, I really want to thank you. We're going to have to do this again because we've got a lot more to talk about.
I hate to say this, but I could keep going.
Well, I think we're going to do this again soon.
Okay, I'd love to.
And the thing that we have here at Big Adventures is all kinds of different adventures show up on this show. And I think what you have shared with us is some of the best we've ever had on this show. So I really appreciate your time. But with that, this is Big Adventures. I hope you guys have enjoyed it. And as I always say, stay right side up. Thanks for being here. And Matt, thank you.
It was an honor. Thank you. I love what you're doing.
Big Adventures is produced by Brian Durker, Margaret Knight, and me, Gavin Bugner. Bill Gleckler and his mandolin provide our music. If you like our show, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Big Adventures with Brian Durker is brought to you by SWCA. Since our founding in Flagstaff in 1981, SWCA Environmental Consultants has helped public and private clients overcome environmental challenges and move their projects forward. As we celebrate our 40th year in business, our 100% employee-owned firm offers comprehensive environmental planning, regulatory compliance, and natural and cultural resources management services. We are the problem solvers, the scientists, the planners, the technical specialists, and the creative thinkers. Thank you, SWCA, for your support of Big Adventures.